days are ripe. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends, listeners to the Lawyers Guild Show, which is what you're now listening to. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Paul, co-host of the program. Maria, you just jumped in your chair at the last minute here. I know you're having another busy day as an attorney. Let our listeners know what's in store for them if they hopefully stay tuned.
Yes. Well, I hope everyone else is jumping up into their chair to listen as well. Today, we're going to be spending the entire hour exploring the question, can the Constitution and the courts restrain Donald Trump? Our guest is our resident constitutional scholar, Stephen Rohde, who's been researching more than 100 lawsuits filed against the Trump administration in an effort to stop the gutting of our federal agencies and protect our individual civil rights and liberties.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. Because after all, the number of active lawsuits in federal courts challenging Trump's administration and his arguments are now topped 100, as Maria said. In 21 of those cases, 21 of them, judges have already issued temporary restraining orders or preliminary injunctions, effectively stopping, at least for now, parts of Trump's agenda. For example, as reported in the New York Times this past Sunday, trial court judges have blocked for now Trump's mass firing of civil servants, Musk's access to sensitive federal agency data, the relocation of transgendered women inmates to men's prisons, the pursuit of immigrants inside houses of worship, and the freezing of up to $3 trillion of federal funding to the states. And in a significant case, a very important case, a federal judge entered a final judgment reinstating the head of the federal watchdog agency. And just yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration, halting which was trying to halt, you know, the sending of those billions of foreign aid dollars. But it's got to be pointed out that in a number of preliminary victories against Trump's actions, the government, though losing the first round in these cases, has nevertheless stalled in obeying the court's orders. And Trump himself, wanting to be king, has posted the absolutist notion that, and I quote, "He who saves his country does not violate any law," close quote. Well, five of the judges who have ruled against Trump were appointed by Republican presidents, one by Trump himself. As a result of Trump's losing record in court cases so far, there's now talk on the right of seeking to impeach judges who have the audacity to rule against the Trump administration. And the number of death threats judges are experiencing from the public have gone up significantly and alarmingly as well. So today, as Maria said, on the Lawyers Guild Show, we conduct our second twice-monthly full-hour review of the more important court cases challenging the attempts of the Trump administration to deconstruct the United States, both legally and politically. And our guest is, as Maria mentioned once again, Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde has himself written a piece entitled, and I quote, "Can the Constitution and the Courts Restrain Donald Trump?" In it, he writes, quote, "It is impossible to measure how cruel, heartless, tyrannical, racist, misogynistic, homophobic, transphobic, chaotic, conflicting, and insane are the 40 or so executive orders Donald Trump has issued as part of his shock and awe strategy. Driven by a fringe notion known as the unitary executive theory, which has been peddled by the Federalist Society and a few arch conservatives on the Supreme Court, Trump is trying to take over the federal government in defiance of the U.S. Constitution, Congress, and maybe even the Supreme Court. Well, by way of further introduction of our guest, Steve Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, constitutional scholar. He practiced civil rights law for almost 50 years. He currently serves as chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He's the past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, as well as the past chair of Death Penalty Focus here in California, and of the group Bend the Ark, a Jewish partnership for justice. But Mr. Rohde wants it to be clear, he's speaking only for himself today. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you very much, Jim and Maria. It's a pleasure to be with you to explore these important issues together.
We better get going because there's a lot of it. Of course, we are friends still. In front, I was just getting ready to wrap that up. We take only a few minutes during the show today, so don't panic. This isn't the way we used to do it. We'd spend 20 minutes trying to wring your arm to give us some money. We just spend a few minutes of it because it's such an important time in our country's history. We don't like to spend too much time doing that. Trouble is, we need the money just as much and probably get less of it because we spend less time asking for it. So we depend on you to be responsible enough and appreciative enough of what we're doing to, when we do talk about it for a few minutes, to respond with your pledges, and we'll get to that at the appropriate times. But Steve, let's start off with our first question. Can you tell us about yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on the billions that have been appropriated in foreign aid that Trump didn't want to have sent? They're holding up. And then, after you've talked about that case, before we discuss other specific cases, if you could perhaps spend a little time giving us your overall reaction to the performance of the U.S. judiciary in the face of so many lawsuits being filed, so many executive orders being challenged, and what have you. Seems to me the courts have, unlike Congress, in the main stood tall, but I want to know what you think about that after you first tell us about that Supreme Court case.
Well, this is an extraordinary time for a constitutional lawyer and activist to be alive. It is testing the guardrails of our system as only rarely in American history they have been tested. This actually was a decision this morning, March 5th, as we all woke up. In the case of Department of State versus AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition. And even the title is important. By the time cases get to the Supreme Court, the loser is in the first position in the name of the case. In the lower courts, the Department of State, the Trump Department of State lost, and the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition and a coalition of other groups that receive and rely on USAID funds have prevailed to this point. I couldn't be more pleased that the first full dress opinion of the court in a 5-4 decision went in favor, in my view, of the rule of law, of the Constitution, and of a program in which money had already been allocated by Congress to be spent on USAID programs. Yet Trump, in his executive orders, tried to stop the money from being spent. So this was teed up as a major challenge to Trump's authority. We'll be talking about that throughout the program. Now, having said everything, anytime our side wins, it's a moment for celebration. The majority opinion was Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Barrett. Those two conservatives joined the three liberals, Justice Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, to give them the 5-member majority. And in a nasty dissent, written by Justice Alito, in which Justices Thomas, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch joined. And I want to just very briefly explain that it had a convoluted history, but a district court had ordered the USAID to spend the money that Congress had allocated. And it went up briefly and very in a short order up through the courts. The majority opinion is one paragraph. We're not getting great writing in this case by the majority, but it's the result that matters. They simply kept in place the order that the funds be spent. But you learn a lot by reading a dissent. And when you get to the first paragraph of a dissent and Justice Alito says, "I am stunned." The best thing we can do these days is to stun Justice Alito. There's been concern about respecting our courts. And yet his dissent is so belittling. It smears the district court. He speaks of the court having brushed aside rulings, shrugged off the government, and other pejoratives like that, that just are belittling of the court system, plows ahead, blithely discards, and that kind of stuff. In any event, for today's purposes, the conservative view, putting the president at the top of the American government, lost in this case. This is a final decision. It is sent back to the district court to implement it. We may see more in this case, and we'll certainly see more in the other cases. But overall, the third branch of government is holding the line. And that's because some brilliant lawyers at the ACLU, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Democratic attorneys general in 16 states have been bringing lawsuits and pursuing what Trump is up to. I'm proud of those lawyers. I think this is a moment where brilliant lawyers are holding the line. They are holding Trump accountable, and judges across the political spectrum are making rulings in very short order that are well-conceived, well-reasoned, and are largely going in favor of the petitioners who are challenging what Trump is doing.
Well, Steve, it would seem that what Trump and company is espousing by way of his executive orders and other actions is what is known as the unified executive theory. I know you've talked about it before briefly, but can you tell us a little more what that means exactly, why people should care about it, and how it would upend the constitutional separation of powers in the governance of the United States? And of course, don't forget to mention where a court issued a final judgment reinstating a special government watchdog, woohoo, that Trump had fired, setting up what's likely to end up in being the first full consideration of Trump's expansive view.
Yes, and that's the case involving Hampton Dellinger, which we'll talk about briefly in a moment. Yes, this is the unitary executive theory. This has been in the works from the Federalist Society, conservative judges, Justices Gorsuch and Thomas espouse this view. What it does is it puts the president at the top of the executive branch, but it really puts him at the top of the entire government. It appears nowhere in the Constitution, nothing to this extent. In fact, the Constitution, as we all know from our studies, has three branches of government. They are called co-equal, and there are checks and balances which affirm the authority of each branch. The president in Section 3 of Article 2 says that he, and I always pause at the male pronoun in the U.S. Constitution, but you'll forgive me for quoting it, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That is the job of the president. Congress passes laws. Congress appropriates money. The president is meant to take care that those laws be faithfully executed. The unitary executive theory turns that on its head, saying that Congress cannot legislate in any way that will impinge on the absolute power of the executive. Put that way, which is, I think, a fair statement of this theory, it's dangerous. It really would put the president beyond the reach of Congress, and in some sense, beyond the reach of the courts enforcing Congress and the Constitution. So we're going to have to watch it. No case yet in the second Trump administration has squarely been framed around the unitary executive theory. But I am heartened that two conservatives today did vote clearly to support opposition to the president. That is a good sign. We can't sit on our laurels, and all of these cases are working their way up through the courts.
Indeed. Well, Steve,
Oh,
if you
and
could.
then I'm
Yes,
sorry, I
absolutely.
did.
No, go
It's
ahead.
a, I'm sorry, it is important. Maria asked me to touch on Hampton Dellinger, which has had a interim Supreme Court ruling on February 21st as well. So there is a Office of Special Counsel in our government. It was established in the 1970s, and that office, in this case, Hampton Dellinger, was appointed in March of 2024 by President Biden. It's a 5-year office. It's meant to carry over at least between two presidential terms, and it exposes unethical and unlawful practices directed at civil servants. It helps ensure whistleblowers who are can expose fraud and waste and abuse. So it's a very important office, and the law says that special counsel can only be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. Trump issued an order firing him, and citing none of those grounds, just he wanted to get rid of him. So this one is teed up, but so far, a majority of the Supreme Court has kept the order in place, keeping Hampton Dellinger in office. Now, they just did it on a procedural basis, holding in abeyance the government's petition. Justices Sotomayor and Jackson would have denied the Trump petition outright. Gorsuch and Alito dissented. But even in this procedural posture, the side of maintaining this ombudsman gained Roberts, Barrett, Kavanaugh, and even Thomas. So there is some hope there. That case itself continues in the courts, but it's the second example of this U.S. Supreme Court siding with these serious challenges to President Trump.
Yes, indeed. And then a few days ago, Steve, the Democratic Party's National Committee took the really unusual step of suing Trump in defense of independent regulatory agencies. What's at stake in that case?
This was very interesting. It's rare for the Democratic Party to sue. They've done it a few times in the past. On February 28, they filed a lawsuit in Washington, D.C., that alleged that in all of his executive orders, which are impinging on independent branches that have been established by Congress, that violates the Constitution. The filing says that particularly focuses on the Federal Election Commission, which Trump has purported to say that he, Trump, can dictate the rulings of the bipartisan Federal Election Commission, and that they cannot issue any ruling or interpret the law contrary, excuse me, contrary to Trump's interpretation of the law. So you have the head of a Republican Party through his alleged power as president dictating what the Federal Election Commission can do. This is going to be a very serious attack because Trump and conservatives have been trying to undermine independent agencies of government for years now. The Supreme Court even cut back on them 2 years ago. But this is a frontal attack saying that you cannot allow a president to countermand the rulings of the bipartisan Federal Election Commission. And I think it's a very important case we're going to have to follow.
Well, another very important case. This past Saturday, the ACLU sued the Trump administration for transferring 10 people who are undocumented to the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. In commenting on this case, you noted, "This case draws much needed attention to one of the United States' longest running human rights violations, now compounded by Trump's cruel immigration policy." Please talk to us about this case.
Yes, this is a case just filed on March 1st. It's called Escalona versus Noem. Here again, the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the International Refugee Assistance Project filed the lawsuit and filed an emergency motion to stay the transfer of 10 undocumented immigrants who are currently in the immigration system fighting their deportation. Yet the government is threatening to transfer them to Guantanamo Bay. My comment that you quoted is meant to highlight that this is the intersection of two outrages. The fact that in violation of the Immigration and Nationality Act and the concept of substantive due process of the Fifth Amendment, these men being threatened with transfer without a court hearing, without lawyers, without review, is extremely dangerous. They have alleged, because it's true, that being moved to Guantanamo would put them in very dangerous conditions, and it would put them beyond access to their lawyers and to family and colleagues and supporters. It is doubling down on Guantanamo Bay, which is this stain on American history, that upwards of over 700 inmates have been held in Guantanamo. Something on the order of 30 remain there. Many of them have been ordered released. And instead of pursuing the policies of the Obama administration and the Biden administration, Trump is using his power to try to transfer them beyond the reach of American law as he sees it. This case will test the limits of his power in a very dramatic and cruel factual situation. And I'm very hopeful that the early rulings will go in favor of those refugees.
Indeed, indeed. Trying to do what they did with so-called prisoners of war. They never treated them like prisoners of war at Guantanamo, giving them the rights that prisoners of war had and putting them out of reach of the courts at that initial phase of that program. Forgive me, friends, 30 seconds of fundraising, maybe a few seconds more. You want to give us a call, if you would, please, at 818-985-5735, or go to our website, kpfk.org, where we have lots of ways of thanking you when you make a contribution. We would hope this kind of programming day after day would be perhaps thanks enough. Your way of letting us know that it's thanks enough, though, is by making a financial contribution, because we can't just with your good wishes, sadly, pay our electric bills and pay our staff the modest salary they receive and so forth. Those of us who are programmers receive nothing at all. You don't hear what we're talking about in any detail on the mainstream corporate media. You hear it only on programs like the Lawyers Guild Show, and you hear other things that you don't hear on mainstream media at KPFK as well. We're a great service to the movement because movement guests who can't get a voice on the corporate media are on our shows and other shows here on a weekly basis, announcing about their demonstrations, inviting people to attend their educational meetings, et cetera, et cetera. So we're really the voice of the progressive movement in LA as well. So for all of those good reasons, $25, you're a full-fledged voting member of KPFK when we vote on various things. $100 would sure be a wonderful gift, and you give us a gift of $100. You find on our website lots of books and records that are hard to get anywhere else than you can hear and receive, and video movies, you name it, $150 will give you more, and so forth and so on. Be as generous as you can, please, my friends. As we continue to talk today on the Lawyers Guild Show, about the current machinations of a neo-fascistic U.S. government, an untold story here in America until now. And we're talking with Steve Rohde, a constitutional expert on these court cases in connection with this struggle. Steve, let me, if I might, ask you about the Trump administration's determination to get rid of programs, and this has been much in the news lately, hasn't it? Seeking, he wants to get rid of programs seeking more diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace, the so-called DEI programs. The Democratic attorney generals, you mentioned 16 states, have issued a detailed memo refuting Trump's executive order eliminating DEI policies and programs. And a number of cases have been brought challenging various executive orders targeting DEI. So, what can you tell us about the strength of these cases and their likely outcome?
I think the United States is in a reckoning when it comes to our pursuit of diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, and belonging. I try very hard not to use Trump's abbreviation of DEI. I think it's purposely intended to conceal what diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, and belonging mean. I today will try to use the word diversity to capture as much of that as possible. Trump is trying to do by executive order to literally erase and silence American history. He is trying to set back the progress haltingly and sparingly that we've made over time to redress the grievances of those in America who have been discriminated against, who have been marginalized and demonized. The notion that we have now reached a colorblind society and therefore no programs for diversity can be tolerated is itself a racist, homophobic, misogynistic approach to American life today and to the teaching of American history. Trump tried this in his first term. He appointed the 1776 Commission, which was meant to paper over our history. Many states, at his urging, have passed laws to eliminate, quote, divisive topics, which may make school children feel guilty about learning about American history. This is the brainchild of arch conservatives who want to, when they say make America great again, it's the again. They want to go back to a time of white supremacy, of a patriarchal society. And they've gotten a chance in his first 45 days to write these executive orders attempting to put into law what so far has been the pet theories of the Federalist Society and arch conservatives. Fortunately, organizations are fighting back. And there are at least two lawsuits currently pending, which we'll talk about briefly right now. One was filed by the American Association of University Professors because these attempts to cut back on the teaching of accurate, comprehensive history has infected our universities and elsewhere. And that is supported by the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education. And another lawsuit was filed by the American Federation of Teachers, the American Sociological Association, and the American Federation of Teachers of Maryland. These lawsuits, I know most of your listeners don't stay up nights reading legal pleadings and complaints. The pleading by the American Federation of Teachers is one of the most clear-minded, articulate defenses of diversity, equity, inclusion, etc. It plainly makes clear that these programs are not illegal. They do not lead to illegal discrimination. And I want to tie into that what you already mentioned in your question, that the attorneys general, and to listeners who hear this show anywhere, you will be proud. The attorneys general of Massachusetts, Illinois, Arizona, California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Vermont, on February 13, issued a comprehensive set of guidelines explaining that there is a lawful path by which diversity can be used in programs that receive federal funding, contractors that receive federal funding, and certainly colleges and universities that receive federal funding. I'm very disappointed when we open the news every day and many corporations are running scared. They are dismantling their diversity programs. I think many of them are going to get in trouble because once having established a program to have recruitment, to encourage people to apply for jobs who've largely been marginalized in the past, to have trainings, to have programs that accommodate people with disabilities, to lift up women and people of color who've been largely excluded and certainly discriminated against. These are affirmative programs that implement the anti-discrimination laws of the 1960s, all of which are still on the books. And what is so illuminating from these lawsuits and the attorneys general opinion is that there are currently in place Department of Education policies that allow for race-conscious programs to address marginalized communities that have previously been excluded from education, the workplace, employment, housing, and all the rest. A moment of reflection on the statistics of how women receive a fraction of what men receive in comparable jobs, of the discrimination in wealth and earnings that people of color suffer in this country. We have hardly reached a colorblind society. And you can have programs. When you're addressing a problem, you need to recognize the problem. You need to have programs that recognize that if people have been discriminated against by reason of their race, national origin, gender, then programs that address those communities are lawful and enforceable. I think these lawsuits have given us a chance to be more outspoken. I think for years we have tippy-toed around in defending these programs. We've allowed the right wing to have its day in raising marginal little stories here and there where they think that someone, a white applicant, has been discriminated against. The Supreme Court's very clear. A few years ago, they did decide that you cannot take race into consideration in college admissions. They did not obliterate race-conscious programs throughout American society. I think these cases are going to be well heard. An interim court has already granted a ruling. Judge Adam Abelson in Maryland on February 21st, and he renewed his opinion recently, have issued a nationwide preliminary injunction preventing the termination of equity-related grants and contracts that promote diversity. Those opinions are well reasoned. That one was 63 pages. That's because these laws are vague. They violate the First Amendment. They violate the rule against viewpoint discrimination. Trump and his Department of Education, so long as he doesn't dismantle it, want to enforce one particular viewpoint of American history and require by law that all teachers abide by that sanitized teaching of American history. Well, these cases are filed. Courts are beginning to recognize their validity. And I think this whole area, as wrenching and as difficult as this period may be, it could be a very important teachable moment.
Thank you for that. But we must take, we're now a minute or two late, actually, our station ID break in the half hour. I apologize for that. And turn it over to our board op to do that for us. But that'll be a very short station break. We'll be right back with you in a minute.
Not only are KPFK listeners smart, interesting, and forward-thinking, you're also very generous and deeply appreciated. Thank you so much for pledging your support to KPFK during our fund drive.
Now back with you as promised. That was a short break. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show here on KPFK. I'm Jim Lafferty along with Maria Hall, my co-host. We're talking with the constitutional scholar, Stephen Rohde. We have Mr. Rohde on twice a month now for the full hour because there's so much to cover in the legal field, the constitutional law field, so many challenges to what the Trump administration and Musk and all are trying to do. Steve, continuing on, as reported in Monday's, I believe it was, New York Times, just in recent days, more than 40 lawsuits have been filed in recent days seeking to erect a bulwark, if you will, in the federal courts against what these lawsuits term Trump's quote-unquote blitzkrieg of executive orders that have upended much of the federal government and challenge the constitutional system of checks and balances, of which you spoke earlier, close quote. Among the cases are five of special interest, so let's review those cases. First, Steve, there's Trump's effort to eliminate, of course, automatic citizenship for babies born in the United States to non-citizens. Talk to us about that case, and then we'll get to some others.
Yes, this was one of the first executive orders he issued, and one of the first cases to challenge it. This is an affront to the Constitution. It's an affront to our American history. Birthright citizenship was provided by the 14th Amendment, passed after the Civil War to guarantee a wide range of rights to formerly enslaved people. And the 14th Amendment literally begins by saying that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. Trump, again, piggybacking on the Federalist Society and conservative law professors and a handful of others, is issuing an executive order that challenges birthright citizenship. He is saying, and he's targeting the children of immigrants and the children of undocumented immigrants. The several cases have well established that America, since the 14th Amendment, follows a doctrine not of blood, but of land. Where you are born in the United States establishes your citizenship from the moment the baby takes its first breath. And this one is clear, and the originalists on the court should read their own 14th Amendment because the language couldn't be clearer. There are a few exceptions. The children of a diplomat living in an embassy in Washington, D.C. or elsewhere That child is the child of the diplomat from a foreign country, and they are not entitled to U.S. citizenship. But that's been decided by the history of the 14th Amendment, how it was written, and the obvious sensibility. And because that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, as you may know, embassies have a certain diplomatic immunity, and in many respects are not subject to traffic laws and other laws in the United States. So serious lawyers have gone to court to defend birthright citizenship. What's behind this is Trump wants to remove future voters who are likely to vote against the Republican Party and in favor of the Democratic Party or a third party. And he sees an avenue to remove an entire class of American citizens that are guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. I think he will lose on that, and I dearly hope, I'd like to see a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court, but we can all hope.
Well, Steve, talk to us about the case where Trump wanted transgender female inmates sent to male-only prisons, and the related case just decided where a federal court in Maryland just blocked nationwide the enforcement of Trump's executive order preventing gender-affirming care for people under 19.
Yes, this was, you know, this is what this president thought was important. So on January 20, within hours of being sworn in, he issued an executive order that there are only two sexes, and to protect women from gender ideology extremism. You know, I guess presidents can do some things by a strike of the black magic marker, but Trump cannot change biology. He cannot change human nature, and he cannot declare that there are only two sexes. This has been teed up because he issued a separate executive order blocking transgender women from ordering them to be transferred to male-only prisons. So transgender women who've lived the recent period of their lives, who are in prison and have been entitled to certain medical care and health care, have been in female prisons. There are actually 2,100 transgender inmates in prisons and halfway houses. So immediately, Judge Royce Lamberth, a Reagan appointee, on February 18, issued a temporary restraining order preventing this cruel transfer of 12 transgender women. Now, then on March 4, just that's yesterday, it was in Maryland, Judge Brendan Herson made that a nationwide injunction. And this is a battle that goes on. When 12 transgender women got the benefit of the first injunction, the second injunction said the issues are parallel. There are similarly situated people across the country who deserve the same protection. And that judge issued a 66-page opinion ordering and preventing those individuals from being transferred to a different gender prison. That case, and I'll say it as long as I can, was filed by the ACLU and the Lambda Legal Defense Fund. It's based on the separation of powers, and the executive order places conditions that Congress did not impose. He is trying to rewrite laws that are already on the books. And there is a case from 1998, a U.S. Supreme Court case that said there is no provision in the Constitution that authorizes the president to enact, to amend, or to repeal statutes. He has no right to do that. That's what he did in this case. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, the courts are going the right way on it.
Yes, indeed. Well, next, Steve, what can you tell us about the case involving the exposing of the identities of those FBI agents who investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol? That, of course, is a sore point with Trump. So what can you tell us about the case involving the fact that the government exposing the identities of those FBI agents who simply were carrying out their duty on January 6th?
Have you no decency, President Trump? What limits will you go to expose? There were something like 6,000 employees that have worked on the January 6th and the Trump classified documents case in Florida. These are hardworking FBI agents. They do their job every day. I think the three of us and many listening have had problems with the FBI going back to J. Edgar Hoover and the abuses of the FBI throughout its history, and we're never going to relent on exposing those. But when you have lawful prosecutions like the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol and the documents case, these employees were doing their job. So, meanwhile, Trump's new Department of Justice, Pamela Jo Bondi, wanted to release the names of these FBI agents. Now, in light of what we saw on January 6th, in light of the Proud Boys and the violence that segment of the MAGA group is willing to pursue, can you imagine them knowing the 6,000 names of those FBI agents, targeting them and their families? So this group of this anonymous group, they didn't want the very lawsuit to expose their names, sought a temporary restraining order to prevent the release of their names. And this was literally pending in court when the government, seeing the writing on the wall, the way the judge was headed, and the petitioners reached an agreement not to release those names pending litigation. There's a hearing set on March 27, and we will hopefully see that that agreement matures into a permanent injunction.
Excellent. Excellent.
Well, speaking of other federal employees who are having a challenging time right now, talk about the coaxing of federal employees to accept deferred resignation under a very tight deadline. What's going on with this case?
Yes, this particular case challenging what Trump and Musk and Doge are doing was filed in the Massachusetts District Court. And fortunately, U.S. District Judge George O'Toole blocked the Trump administration from implementing its deferred resignation coercive program. They said that employees could accept 8 months of pay and benefits without working as long as they resigned in this coming September. Now, you know, we should say in every one of these cases, and we've tried to emphasize this, I think, and you have done so on your show, these cases involve real people. You know, they involve starving people in foreign countries that are receiving the food grown by American farmers through the USAID program. They affect those FBI agents. They affect individuals in every single case that I'm talking about today with you. And in this case, they're talking about federal employees, hardworking people who got an email one day and they are being coerced into voluntarily quitting. Because if they quit, they give up all their rights. They cannot sue. They cannot seek to be reinstated. And so again, fortunately and temporarily, Judge O'Toole has restrained that program, and further hearings are pending.
Right. And then we have Trump's effort to freeze as much as, well, $3 trillion, to try to freeze $3 trillion in domestic spending. Isn't that the job of Congress? What have the courts said so far about that issue?
It sure is. And I think by now, listeners are catching on that these are independent judges. Our federal judiciary, by and large, with very few exceptions, is made up of independent judges who follow the law and they follow the facts. I've stood before some of them. They've ruled for me. They've ruled against me. But they've done so based on the facts and the law. So here we have two injunctions regarding the domestic funding freeze. A judge, John McConnell in Rhode Island and Judge Angel Kelly in Massachusetts put holds on these cuts. But here, and those will be having further hearings, but just, and I haven't even mentioned examples of how the government, lawyers and the government, are trying to dodge some of these orders. Here was an order in the Massachusetts case to hold those cuts, but the government held up funding anyway by forbidding health officials from giving public notice of grant review meetings that would be held. So they thought they found a loophole. They introduced a procedural obstacle. They are being dragged back into court in front of these judges. If these lawyers persist in this, and we've seen lawyers go down who defended Trump, many of them were disbarred and disciplined. If these DOJ lawyers now under the new administration continue to misrepresent the facts to judges who are tolerating and counseling the evasion of these orders, they are going to have hell to pay in front of these judges.
Yeah. You know, Maria, I'd suggest maybe we go to that last question that I know you want to ask, I wanted to have asked. Given time and some other business we have to do. So why not just go to that last question, if you would?
Sure. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. It always goes too fast. So, Steve, you've recently written that lawsuits are necessary but not sufficient in the battle to stop Trump from destroying our democracy. What did you mean by that? And what should people be doing as these lawsuits work their way through the courts?
Well, In preparing for our program today and doing some of the writing I'm doing every week, it dawned on me that having had these successes in court so far and having good lawyers at the ramparts, some people might relax. Some people might sit back and say, oh, the lawyers and the judges are taking care of all this. That would be a terrible, terrible mistake. As I said, these lawsuits are necessary. It's important to go toe-to-toe with this administration, but it's also important for we the people to protest. There is International Women's Day on Saturday. Protests are being organized around the country. I know that ICUJP and Jim Lafferty is organizing a protest at the a Tesla dealership to bring attention to Doge and the unelected Musk that is rampaging through American government. Those protests matter. They matter for the people who participate in them, you and me and others, to stand shoulder to shoulder, to feel that we are not alone. Far too many people I talk to are despairing. They are sitting at home, they're throwing up their hands, they feel there's no hope. And it is in being physically present and in these rallies. Then there's other work, postcards. The group Indivisible across the country is forming community actions. There's a whole range of groups you can find. So it is important that we stand in solidarity. We need to call the White House. We need to call our senators and congresspersons. We need to have the Democratic Party build some spine and some resistance. That's as important, because those things affect judges or people. They read the newspapers. They see where the public is headed. I think if we all do our part, we can come through this devastating attack on our democracy.
Well, Steve Rohde, I can only say you're sure doing your part and then some. And we so appreciate what you're doing this every couple of weeks. This is not easy work. This is not something that, you know, many of our guests can simply come in and they're familiar with their subject and they just rattle off what they're doing and so forth. For Steve to do this, it requires a lot of hours, a lot of, I mean, he's a brilliant lawyer, but that doesn't mean you can't not read the cases. You can't not read all the commentary about the cases, what the judges are doing, and then come on the air and give a report to non-lawyers, which is what most of our audience is, and expect them to understand it. And I've had any number of people tell me how wonderful you are at that, Steve. So once again, we appreciate your hard work in that regard and for what you did again today. We have to say goodbye to you only because we need to take the last couple of minutes to remind people that this is still a fun drive. Where else would you hear? I don't think CBS, I don't think CNN was banging on Steve Rohde's door. They should be, but I don't think they were asking him to come on and give this kind of hour-long recitation of what the courts are doing to try to stop Trump and his march towards full authoritarianism. I think that's what you get here at KPFK. That's what you get at our station. That's what you get on the Lawyers Guild show. And if you want to honor that, if you want to thank for that, if it was ever a time, KPFK and Pacific has always been important. It's always important to have a real, honest alternative to the corporate media in America, God knows. But I'm telling you, I can't think, and I'm in my 80s, I can't think of a time when it was as important as it is at this moment to make sure that this station can stay on the air, can pay the damn rising electric bills, can pay its employees a living wage, and continue to bring you this kind of alternative radio, this kind of speaking of truth to power that Amy Goodman coined day after day, hour after hour, along with our unique music programs and all sorts of other programming that we bring. So please, my friends, give us a call at 818-985-5735. Let us know you do appreciate that, please. Also, go online at kpfk.org. Maria, you like to do that. Have you gotten yourself any more cups? Or I know Maria has a great collection of KPFK cups. You can get cups, T-shirts, and what else, Maria?
Right, the tote bag. There's just some great music, and I always get my gifts for the year for other people.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
But it is, you know, one thing about, you know, we know that NPR and PBS are in the sights of this administration. KPFK is not federally funded. So in that sense, we are more free. But we do rely on listeners.
We do rely on listeners. And the Project 2025 specifically mentioned the Pacifica Network as a network that ought not to be licensed because of our one-sidedness, you know, and our critique of the Trump administration and Republican administration and Democratic administration. We criticize any government action, be it by the Democratic Party or the Republican Party in control, that isn't benefiting the working people, the people of this country that deserve to be number one on the agenda, if you will, and not afterthoughts getting nothing but crumbs from corporate America. So my friends, please, the music's gonna start to play now, I know any minute. Maybe it's starting already. I don't know. It's hard for me to hear it where I'm sitting. But before it does, and even as it's playing, and even when the show is over, if you'd give a call to 818-985-5735, we would be so appreciative, so very appreciative. Indicate you're pledging on behalf of the Lawyers Guild show. That makes us feel good, too. But wherever you choose to pledge during this pledge drive, do it, because that's what we need. We're all part of a family here. As I always say, when you give to the station, you're also giving to the entire progressive movement in LA, because we, more than any other radio outlet in this city, have on organizers and leaders from the various progressive causes And there we are. So the music is playing. Give us a call. We'll be back with you again next week. Until we do, this is Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall. Thank you so much for listening today and pledging today. Asking you to stay healthy, stay active, and stand up for your rights, my friends.
Don't give up the fight.
Support comes from the Hammer Museum at UCLA, presenting Alice Coltrane Monument Eternal, now on view through May 4th.